GreenSense is brought to you by JLT Specialty USA, the world's largest energy insurance broker, serving the entire energy continuum. Visit JLTUS.com.
Welcome to GreenSense, a weekly look at the people, policies, and innovations that are changing our world. Here's Robert Colangelo.
That's me, scientist, author, and environmental entrepreneur, and I get to do all the easy work.
I'm behind the scenes, working the phones, doing the planning, Bob Kessler, executive producer. Clothing and shoes use tremendous amounts of resources, but what if they could actually reduce waste and help people living in poverty? We'll see if Timberland's new approach to shoemaking could do that. Fighting wars over water, it's something that a lot of environmental experts we've met are predicting. But we have a top water rights lawyer who says water access can actually help people resolve their conflicts. And we'll start things off with the fit foodie chef Mariah Ibrahim with a healthy, sustainable recipe.
Our friend, the fit foodie, Chef Mariah Ibrahim, is here to kick off GreenSense in style with a healthy, sustainable recipe just in time for Mother's Day, which is in a couple of weeks. Oh. Hello, Chef. How's beautiful California?
It is spectacular today. Gorgeous, gorgeous day.
Why are eggs so important to Easter? What's the symbolism between eggs and Easter? Do you know?
Well, I think it has a little bit of history and heritage and tradition. I don't know the exact reason, but
I think eggs represent rebirth. You know, it's life, and sure. Easter is all about the rebirth and life. So I think that's the connection. But you have a connection to eggs because you got an egg recipe for us today.
I was going to say, I just think they're delicious. So that's why I think that they're important for this time of year. And they're so versatile. You know, they're a great source of protein. They have good fat. And, you know, a lot of the data now from recent times are showing that, you know, eggs are not really responsible necessarily for raising your cholesterol. So, you know, I say go for it. If you like them, eat them and eat them whole. There is a lot of benefit from eating the yolk as well. So this recipe is so easy. And here's the thing. Does everybody have a muffin pan?
Yes. Out there? I see all the hands up there. Yep.
I think you do. Now, instead of getting a muffin top from that muffin pan, I'm going to put it to good use and making this awesome brunch idea. And it's perfect for Mother's Day. One, because it's perfectly portioned. So everybody gets what they need and it's delicious. And it's the right amount, you know, the right portion size. And then two, it looks elegant. And three, it's so easy to make. It literally makes itself. You ready?
We're ready.
Okay, here's how it works. You take your muffin pan, crack an egg into each muffin pan little center. And then you can top it with any myriad of toppings. So I just made a batch today. So it's like fresh in my mind. Literally just whipped up a batch. And it has uncured bacon. It's got cremini mushrooms. It's got garlic. It's got spring onions. And a little bit of fresh mozzarella with some fresh rosemary. How does that sound?
That's simple.
So simple and so delicious. It really is because you're just taking those ingredients, you're dropping them right on top of the egg, stick it in the oven for, it's going to take you about 18 to 20 minutes on, and the temperature is going to be 350 so that you don't burn the top. And it'll really nicely slow cook the eggs. And they're just so good. They're delicious. They freeze beautifully. If you make an extra batch, which I'm all about making extra and having it for a later time.
Now, Chef, do you have to scramble the egg or do you have to put grease in the pan? You just crack the egg and put it in the pan?
Correct. Of course, if you're using a muffin pan that needs to be greased first, I use a silicone muffin pan and it doesn't need any greasing, which is great because you don't have to add extra oil in there if you don't want that. But if you've got a regular metal muffin pan, yes, grease it first so that they don't stick, but I love the silicone ones and it makes it really easy for the muffins to pop out.
you've done it again. You've intrigued me. I'm going to go try this recipe since we're off the air.
I'll send you a picture of what I made today, too.
Well, thanks for joining us, and we'll look forward to talking to you in a couple of weeks.
Sounds great. Thank
you. Have a wonderful Mother's Day.
You too, to everybody out there.
Chef Maria, the fit foodie with another healthy, sustainable recipe. Learn more about her at chefmaria.com. You can watch Chef Maria prepare this recipe on Facebook Live. We've linked it on this week's show notes for the Green Sense Radio podcast. Subscribe when you visit greensensefarms.com. Clothing production uses a lot of resources and can have an impact on the environment. It takes around 700 gallons of water to produce a single cotton t-shirt, according to the World Wildlife Federation. But there are efforts within the industry to reduce the environmental impact of clothing and shoe production. One company leading the way is Timberland, a brand name that's been around since 1973. And to tell us more about it is Margaret Moray-Rooner, Timberland's Director of Strategic Partnerships. Welcome, Margaret.
Thank you, Robert.
The big announcement came in March that you're working with the company Thread, which is designated as a B or a benefit corporation. What's special about the materials that are being used in making shoes and boots this way, which is called ground to good?
Yes. The unique thing about Thread's material that they offer us using their ground to good fabric is that it's made with post-consumer recycled PET from water bottles that are collected from trash heaps in the country of Haiti. And they're collected through a network of individuals who are paid dignified wages. And Thread has a relationship with all of those individuals and the people who run the collection centers. And so that gives both Thread and Timberland a unique extended level of transparency to what Thread would refer to as the first mile, which allows us to know exactly where the bottles come from, who picked them up, and how their lives were impacted as a result of their commitment to doing the job of picking up the bottles and taking them to the recycling centers.
Well, I imagine you need a lot of material to make boots. Are there enough water bottles in Haiti to provide you with that constant supply?
Yes, unfortunately, there are way too many discarded water bottles in Haiti, and that's often the case in poor countries around the world where trash collection is not a priority due to a lack of infrastructure in those markets. And so when Ian Rosenberger, the founder of Thread, he visited the country right after the earthquake. He's a photographer and a filmmaker, and he went there with the idea of trying to help. And he would say he did exactly what he wasn't supposed to do. He went right to the site of the earthquake at Ground Zero to try and help without any idea of how he was going to do that. And one of the first things that struck him was the amount of trash and garbage that was in the country in general. And that was the case prior to the earthquake. And so what we like to say is we dream of the day when we will run out of supply of recycled PET to put into our products. But the bottom line is that day's very, very far off, unfortunately.
Well, give us the bullet points of why this is good for the environment.
Well, the fact that it allows us to basically replace virgin materials is the number one opportunity to reduce our impact on the environment as a manufacturer of goods. The fact that it allows us to create our choice to use Thread's material versus another company's, another supplier's recycled PET fabric means that we can trace all the way back, as I said, to the first mile. And that means that we know that there are dignified and legitimate jobs that are being created for individuals that are making their lives better as a result. And also, I think in general, the idea that our choice, we at Timberland are trying to use as much recycled, renewable, and organic materials in our products as possible. As a matter of fact, in 2020, we have a goal to try to get to a point where 100% of all of our products use some aspect of those materials. And we're hoping that that goal and our journey to get to that goal inspires other brands to reduce their amount of virgin materials and increase their commitment to recycled, renewable, and organic materials.
Timberland's been around almost nearly 100 years, and sometimes companies that have been around a long time have difficulties changing the corporate culture. How were you able to change this culture to get people in the organization to start thinking about making shoes sustainably?
For us, it actually hasn't really been, there hasn't been a need to change our culture. Our culture has always been one of an outdoor lifestyle company that's committed to maintaining the outdoors and reducing our impact on the outdoors. We recognize that as an outdoor lifestyle company, if we don't, we have an accountability to serve nature. And if we don't, then we could come to a point someday that there will be no outdoors to enjoy, and that's not a good proposition for our business. We have a lot of different programs in our organization, both there are extrinsic programs that help us attract employees, and one of those is 40 hours of community service, paid community service every year for all full-time employees, and a lot of those hours are spent doing outdoor work on Rails the Trails and things like that, and with the Appalachian Mountain Club and here in New England and a lot of other places. So we have both some cultural elements that we've built into the day-to-day. And then also all of our, I mentioned our goal to have 100% of our product line feature recycled renewable organic materials by 2020. And everybody is accountable in the organization for doing their part in delivering that goal in their goals and objectives as employees.
You're listening to Green Sense. I'm Robert Colangelo. My guest is Margaret Moray Rooner, Timberland's Director of Strategic Partnerships, and we're talking about their recent move to manufacture shoes more sustainably. Margaret, what's the biggest challenge in making shoes sustainably? And I'm sure you have all the common market goals that you have to keep. Shoes must be stylish, durable, and functional, as you've always made them. So where is the biggest challenge?
I think one of the biggest challenges is finding a network of suppliers who can provide us with access to the right types of materials that are responsibly sourced. Also, identifying and integrating new processes that might be required to help us build more sustainable products and more responsible products. Perhaps it's the use of adhesives that are less bad for the environment, and we've recycled materials, reaching beyond recycled PET, looking at other materials. For example, we used to use recycled car tires in our outsoles, and due to government regulations in Europe, we had to move away from that because of post-consumer use, the level of chemicals in tires, and so that went into to recycled materials that were made with those tires. So we've had to move away, use post-industrial latex, and that was a step back for us because we prefer to use post-consumer recycled materials rather than post-industrial. So there's all kinds of there's all kinds of barriers that we face in the day-to-day course of trying to do good, but that just presents we look at it as presenting an opportunity to transcend and move beyond, to move the needle.
Well, to be truly sustainable, there must be economic benefit, and that can come in many ways. Talk about the economics of using these new materials and manufacturing shoes in a more sustainable manner.
Yeah, there is a overarching sense, I believe, amongst consumers that buying green costs more, and certainly in some instances that's true. But the great thing about a company and a brand like Timberland, which we are a global business, we're a very large brand, we can buy to scale, which helps the cost proposition. We're very adamant with our partners who are suppliers of greener materials, if you will, that there has to be a cost benefit. They can't, we can certainly pay a little bit more. We make premium products, and we can build we can put those materials that cost a little bit more into our products because we command higher prices for our premium products. But it has to be, it can't be too much more. But our buying power, like I said, to scale gives us a little bit more leverage. And we also know that when all things are equal around style and performance of a product, if a product has a green material in it, the consumer sees that as a gift with purchase, and we can win over the competition that doesn't offer green materials or responsible materials almost every time, which is a huge benefit in moving sales and moving the needle.
Well, you're offering 5 styles of men's footwear, 2 bags and 1 t-shirt, all made using ground-to-good fabric. Are there plans to expand this line?
Yes, there are. We're looking to expand into a larger range of apparel, from outerwear to denim, and we're looking to also offer an additional range of footwear. And we're working with Thread to see if we can't get to a point where they can offer us internal materials that we use, that we currently use, that are made with recycled PET like liners in our boots and shoes and even laces. So that would, again, allow us to increase the volume that we're buying. And there's an economic business case to be made for that transition as well.
Have you seen any change in sales since you've made this announcement?
We've had some. We're very, very pleased. We're very excited about the reaction to the product line, and we're very, very excited about the level of sales that we've achieved to date, and that it's validated our hypothesis that consumers really do care about this stuff, and we believe that we're at the tipping point of a new age of consumers' demand for a deeper level of transparency from brands, and so we think this is a good first step to increase and expand the level of transparency, and we're allowing our ability to tell the story with Thread about Ground to Good fabric and introduce consumers to the people who have been involved in every step of the supply chain allows us to make an enhanced emotional connection with the consumer to the people that they've helped, whose lives they've helped make better as a result of their choice to purchase these products.
That's Margaret Morey-Rooner, Timberland's Director of Strategic Partnerships. I'm Robert Colangelo on GreenSense, where you can subscribe to our podcasts on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play when you visit greensensefarms.com. World Water Week is coming up later this year in Stockholm, Sweden, where experts gather to discuss solutions to the world's water issues. It was recently announced that Stephen McCaffrey, a distinguished professor of law at the University of the Pacific in Sacramento, California, will be honored with the 2017 Stockholm Water Prize. As one of the world's top experts on international water law, he joins us now on GreenSense. Welcome, Stephen.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Congratulations on being awarded the Stockholm Water Prize. Give us some context.
Well, I have to be careful not to be immodest. It's generally regarded in the field as being the top prize in relation to water. As far as I can tell, no lawyer has received it before, and maybe for good reason, I don't know. But most of the recipients are either organizations or individuals who have done good work to bring water to disadvantaged communities, for example, or increase efficiency of water use, that kind of thing.
Well, let's talk a little bit about why you won. In some of your own writings, you've articulated the human right to water. This was later recognized by the UN General Assembly as a right in 2010. How have your efforts improved access to water for people around the world?
Well, most of the effort in terms of time has been devoted to the development of a worldwide treaty on water that's shared by more than one state. And there are over 470 of these international drainage basins in the world, which account for something like 60% of global freshwater flows, and in which about 40% of the world's population lives. So as the population grows, the amount of water stays finite. You can imagine that the potential for conflict increases. So we need some universally accepted framework that governs the relations between countries sharing this precious resource. And that's what I put in a lot of work on, and which we have now.
Well, you've served as legal counsel for numerous disputes between countries over shared water resources. What are the areas where there is the most conflict over water these days, and how can they be resolved?
Well, conflicts occur all over the world, so you can't just kind of pinpoint where they would be where they would arise most frequently. But increasingly, we're seeing that environmental considerations are raised in these disputes and may even be what sparked the dispute in the first place, although often it's a question of allocation. How much does each country get? Or perhaps a dam. So this kind of bears out the idea that as the population grows, amount of water stays finite. It's almost inevitable that you're going to have not necessarily disputes, but the need to for countries to work together to agree on allocation issues. But as I say, the environment is increasingly coming up. And it did in a case between Pakistan and India that was a big arbitration in which the accusation by Pakistan was that India's planned dam on the Kishanganga River violated a 1960 treaty between the two. That treaty didn't use the word environment, and yet the tribunal took environmental considerations into account in deciding that India had to release a certain amount of water through the dam to preserve downstream flows for basically for the environment.
Well, the challenge with water that I see is either you have too much of it or too little of it. You know, through climate change, we're seeing coastal sea levels rise, and so they have too much water, and around the equator, there's too little water. Could water conflicts become more difficult and intricate as climate change continues?
Yes, I think without doubt, both domestically and internationally. This is going to be a huge driver. Studies have actually been made about whether water is more of an agent for conflict or cooperation. And these studies have concluded that they tend to lead more to cooperation, partly because conflicts can get messy and their outcomes are unpredictable. So ultimately, it's in countries' best interest to figure out a way to cooperate over water rather than get involved in any kind of conflict, be it armed or simply diplomatic. So I really am hopeful. I guess I'm an optimist, but I'm hopeful that the coming increased water shortages will be an agent for cooperation. And that seems to be happening around the world.
Let's talk a little bit about closer to home. Water disputes that may come up in our own country. California, where you're based, for instance, Western water rights that have evolved over the centuries are not logical, economical, or make environmental sense. Do you ever see conflict arising over those issues, or do you see those as a bridge to bring people together?
Oh, yes, there are ongoing conflicts. Fortunately, not armed ones, although quite a while ago, Arizona threatened to call out their National Guard to prevent California from using Colorado River water. But Mark Twain is reputed to have said, "Whiskey's for drinking, water's for fighting over." And no one can actually find a source of that, but it sounds like Twain. And indeed, in the West, you have, you know, fights between adjoining farmers, you know, over water in a ditch and that kind of thing. And this problem becomes magnified when we start engineering our water systems the way we have in California, with so much water being moved from the northern part of the state through canals to the southern part of the state, which wouldn't exist but for that water, at least wouldn't exist in its present form. So obviously there is some bitterness on the part of the northerners, of which I am one, and the southerners, I think, at this point feel entitled to that water, and indeed they are. I mean, this has been set up by the federal government and the state of California, and it's existed for a long time, and you can't just kind of take it away. However, it's a situation that is repeated throughout the arid West. And Las Vegas, for example, as a city that depends entirely on water that doesn't, it's not endogenous. It isn't from Las Vegas. It's from the Colorado River. And the city grows, and the Las Vegas water managers have to figure out some way to supply that city with water. So yes, we're going to have challenges, let's just put it that way, in the future due to climate change over water domestically as we do internationally.
As you mentioned earlier, you consider yourself an optimist and stand by the studies that have shown that shared fresh water is generally a catalyst for cooperation rather than conflict. Explain how this can be.
Yes. This can come about in a number of ways. The best way, of course, is for the countries themselves to initiate a dialogue toward cooperation. This cooperation is most effectively created and managed through a joint commission. And there are many, many, many joint river commissions or joint water commissions throughout the world that countries sharing freshwater resources have established to facilitate the cooperation. And typically the commissions are staffed not by diplomats, but by experts who actually can get along because they aren't as influenced by political considerations. So that's one way that cooperation can be realized effectively. Another way, of course, is if the countries themselves don't spontaneously enter into cooperation, is through an outside party, such as an international financial institution like the World Bank, for example, which can demonstrate to a country how it can develop sustainably through the construction of a dam, for example, although those aren't universally loved. And such an investor as the World Bank will want to make sure that this dam isn't going to spark a conflict with another country. So it will tell the recipient country, look, you need to work things out with your upstream or downstream neighbor so that this dam doesn't actually spark a conflict, because that's the last thing we want to do. So there are various ways in which cooperation can eventuate. The best is for the parties themselves to initiate it. And perhaps they need some help along the way. When you have two states who are neighbors, the chances are at least 50-50, if you look at experience worldwide, that they're not going to like each other much in the first place, oddly enough. So some outside help might be necessary to start that cooperative relationship.
That's Stephen McCaffrey, a distinguished professor of law at the University of the Pacific in Sacramento, California, who will be honored with the 2017 Stockholm Water Prize. I'm Robert Colangelo on GreenSense, reminding you to subscribe to our podcast at iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play when you visit greensensefarms.com. Thanks for listening to this week's edition of GreenSense. If there's anything on your mind or you have some thoughts, send me an email to robert@greensenseshow.com. Subscribe to the GreenSense Radio podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play by visiting greensensefarms.com and view the list of radio stations that air our show. Our goal is to be an honest broker of sustainable information so that you can make informed decisions. Stay fresh, keep innovating, because when you're green, you grow.
GreenSense is recorded in the Duneland ecosystem on the eastern shores of Lake Michigan at GreenSense Farms, the largest indoor commercial vertical farm in the world. We walk the walk and talk the talk, growing leafy green vegetables 24/7, free of pesticides, herbicides, with non-GMO seeds, conserving resources, and reducing waste. Watch us grow. The program is copyright GreenSense Farms, all rights reserved.
GreenSense is brought to you by JLT Specialty USA, the world's largest energy insurance broker, serving the entire energy continuum. Visit jltus.com.